Captain Kenneth Stark and a Lieutenant Colonel Kenneth Lay. Colonel Lay has been Public Relations Director for Ripon College for some years now, since his retirement from the Army. Colonel Clifton went on to a distinguished military career as Assistant Chief of Army Information, military, Senior Military Aide to President Kennedy, Senior Military Aide to President Johnson, and now as Washington Representative of the Association of American Advertising Agents, and a Public Relations Consultant. From 1946 to 1974, some 150 Army, Navy, and Air Force officers earned master's degrees at the University of Wisconsin in Journalism under my direction. The last four Chiefs of Information in the U.S. Army have been Wisconsin graduates. During the Eisenhower presidency, the Army came upon hard times. And in 1957, when General Maxwell Taylor was made Chief of Staff, he brought back Ted Clifton from Europe to help turn the university, the Army's public relations around. And in 1958-9, Ted Clifton and I discussed at some length the need for a summer refresher course for Army officers to give them new stimulus to increase their prestige with their colleagues. And out of that came the Army summer course. In the Army jargon, the master's program was always referred to as the long course, and the 8-week summer course, the short course. Each summer, starting in 1959, some 25 or so Army officers were sent here for 8 weeks. In this 8 weeks, they took two regular university courses, mass communication and society and public relations, and in addition had special courses in radio, television, and Army case problems. The latter two, of course, were for no credit. That program has continued to this time. This past summer, Professor Douglas Jones, who used to be here on the faculty, who was one of the Army students sent here to get a master's many years ago, conducted the program. Also, I might mention that 1959, that same year we started the Army summer program, I started the Public Relations Society of America Institute, which is still going. Hale Nelson of Illinois Bell Telephone Company and I developed the first Public Relations Society of America Institute and started that program here in 1959. We also held one here in 1960, and then because I didn't want to be tied down every summer, I encouraged the society to move it around to other campuses. It was sort of coming apart, so I agreed to bring it back here in 1971 to revive it, which I did, and that program is still going, and it's one of the most constructive things the Public Relations Society of America does. The Navy and the Air Force started sending officers here in recent years. We've had only about three Air Force Master's candidates, and we've had some 20 or so Navy Master's candidates. These officers that were sent here were uniformly high quality. Of the some 150, I would say only half dozen or so really were not qualified to do graduate work. All but one of them, however, completed his master's degree, earned his master's degree. I don't think of anything else, Donna.
Well, there was one subject that occurred to me that I had meant to ask about. Am I correct? Didn't you do some work with Merle Curdy on the subject of philanthropy at some
point? Yes. I was part of the History of Philanthropy project, which it grew out of a conference at Princeton, which Merle Curdy took part on the bibliography of philanthropy. The realization that this was an area of American history that had been little studied, little written about. The consequence that Professor Curdy got a large grant from the Ford Foundation for a history of philanthropy project. Irv Wiley, who later went on to become Chancellor UW Parkside, was the director of the project. And I was asked by Professor Curdy if I would do the history of fundraising in the United States. And I worked on that project from 1960 to 1964 with research support at least two summers and one semester on the Ford Foundation, which resulted in my book, The History of Fundraising in the United States, Its Role in American Philanthropy, which traces the story of public mass, public fundraising, which has greatly altered the nature of American philanthropy. My interest in doing the study was to show, at least in this limited area, the great impact that public relations practice has on society in the United States, an impact that generally goes undiscerned and undiscussed. Some 75,000 public relations practitioners exert a great influence on the course of our society, and yet because they operate in the shadows, they're not much studied or scrutinized as they indeed deserve to be because of their role in our public information system. So that was a very rewarding association collaboration. And I learned a great deal from Professor Curdy, who was a dear friend, about historiography that I failed to learn when I was a graduate student.
You described yourself as a frustrated historian.
I am a frustrated. If the one thing about my life that I would change if I were doing it all over would be to get a PhD in American history.
Well, you have worked in this area. I read a statement that interested me, to the effect that you made a proposal for a presidential commission to investigate national fund drives. And the thing that interested me particularly was this happened a long time before Watergate and all that associated.
Well, the fact is that fundraising, so much of fundraising operates in a very twilight area of fraud. The news media do not adequately scrutinize and report and investigate fundraising drives. The media are inclined to give publicity to every fundraising drive in equal proportion as a so-called public service. The fact
is...
Is
coffee cooking?
No.
Yes.
Huh?
Coffee is boiling away.
I'm sorry.
I could smell it.
Talking about the media.
The media do not adequately scrutinize and investigate fundraising appeals to the public. Thus, the public has no reliable information on, as a basis to judge the merit of each fundraising appeal. If you look at our national fund drives, there's no relationship between the merit of the need and the amount of money raised.
And nobody knows how the money is dispersed.
That's right.
Either.
There's not adequate reporting of the disbursement. When I say that you can operate right on the edge of fraud legitimately, I'm thinking, for example, of the disabled veterans, their identotapes. They send these identotapes out. People think, well, it'll help a veteran, I'll send them 50 cents or a dollar. All it does is help the people in the headquarters of that effort. Congressional investigation of many years ago showed that something like 85 to 90% of the money raised by this identotags goes to administration. See, you can't legislate that a fund must spend only some portion of, a particular portion of its income on fundraising. Much of the fundraising is very expensive and wasteful. For example, your sealed campaigns, TB seals, Easter seals, it costs about 30 cents on a dollar to raise that money. And yet, if you deny the individual appeal, you deny the individual educational opportunity the appeal offers. And then if you get your federated fundraising, as you do with United Way, you get a business domination and rigidity that's not healthy either. I do not argue that there should be only one health fund drive or one social welfare drive, but I do argue that there ought to be federal regulation, which includes federal reporting of income and disbursements of all fund drives, so that the public has more adequate information to judge the merit of an appeal, because each one of us gets more appeals for funds than we have money to meet. So I think we ought to know the National Foundation, for example, which has tremendous assets, is raising a great deal of money combat birth defects, which is a very minor problem in terms of society health. The model for this mass national health fundraising is, of course, the March of Dimes, which was a creation of Carl Beyer, one of the nation's public relations pioneers. Now, infantile paralysis, while devastating to those who suffer it and those who members of families of those who have suffered it, was not a major national health problem. I think the maximum number of cases in any one year was something like 16,000. Yet this tremendous sum of money was raised. There's
Don't you suppose that the fact that President Roosevelt had been afflicted with this?
Oh, sure, sure.
Had something to do with it.
And that was conceived. He had gone into debt for Warm Springs, which he paid a pretty fancy price for. And he had to be bailed out there, and so Basil O'Connor was the one that saw the opportunity for a national fundraising effort and brought in Carl Beyer. And Beyer originally started with the birthday balls and then moved in ultimately in the March of Dimes. But with the public now, there is Virginia Hart has been advocating legislation here for more rigid reporting of and registration of fundraising efforts. Wisconsin did pass a law some years ago, but it was ineffective because it eliminated educational and veterans organizations. Veterans organizations are, you know, they have their tag days and their identical tags and stuff.
Well, you make it sound as though there's more work to be done in this
area. Oh, yes, yes. There's need for state, may not get a federal work. Now, some states have it, New York State, City of Los Angeles. You can't carry on a fund drive in City of Los Angeles unless you're registered with the city. In order to register, you have to submit an audited account of your receipts and disbursements of the prior year. So they're forced to account. There's inadequate accounting by many of the fundraising efforts, and there's inadequate press scrutiny of many of the fundraising efforts. In short, there's tremendous sums of money being given today for somewhat dubious causes because of lack of public information.
I would just like to add, in addition to thank you for taking this time, that I have a feeling that the University of Wisconsin-Madison is going to miss you.
Well, it's nice to be missed. It's also nice to be wanted in Georgia.